Antorcha Olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a una atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap.
So, coming your way next, it's Bathrop Spears broadsides the November 10th, 2022 show. Kind of up against the deadline, so there's going to be less music than usual, which is too bad because music breaks it all up nicely. But we have a couple of long interviews, one with J.C. Orton of the Street Spirit up in Berkeley, who is also a man who feeds homeless people and distributes papers. He's a distributor of that. And he's we talk a wide-ranging series of subjects, or rather I kind of stray off into the spiritual, which isn't the usual for me, but you get to hear some of that anyway if you persist in listening. And then we have another long interview with Dreamcatcher, Michael Orr, as he's also known by his court records, homeless old-timer in Santa Cruz and artist who I've been talking to for decades, well, over a decade, that's for sure, maybe over two, and I'm not for sure about that. And then we're going to have me endlessly going on, or perhaps not so endlessly, on this particular show, because what I'm going to probably play are some of these interviews in their entirety in order to beat the 6 o'clock deadline that I have for playing these shows on Thursday night. I'm getting up against it. It's already 3:30, almost 3:40, and that's going to require me to skimp on the music and skimp on the commentary, probably. But you'll get some stuff, so don't dismay. Probably also have some segments from the latest Huff meeting, which we're continuing to do every Thursday if you're interested. If you find the kind of stuff I talk about on the show intriguing, and you like my stuff online under the name Robert Norse, that's me, N-O-R-S-E, well, you might be interested in Huff meeting and Huff work. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We're concerned with establishing kind of a continuing narrative about what's really going on with homeless folks, at least from a few sets of eyes, and also to rather critically examine the city's narrative in Santa Cruz, the notion that it's doing a good job or an adequate job or the best it can or effectively spending its money or treating homeless people fairly or conditions are improving, that sort of thing, when in fact the opposite is the case. So we're going to jump into it and jump with us, and we'll all get wet. But in spite of the moisture, we'll probably maybe be a little closer to the truth when we dry off.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it. appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So there is a city council meeting coming up on Tuesday in Santa Cruz, but we don't get the news of what exactly is on their agenda until tonight, if you're listening to this on Thursday the 10th, or Friday the 11th, which is more likely, unless you stay up late. And so I can't really talk to you about it until the Sunday show, which presumes that that one happens. And that's going to be happening on the 27th? No, I'm jumping ahead of my calendar a bit. That'll be happening on the 13th, if it happens at all. I keep being a little conditional about things because I'm trying to give myself leeway to take a break, do other things, and throw a bunch of flashbacks at you, which aren't always that bad. I kind of hope that some of you listen to at least some of the flashbacks on the Sunday show during my last show, which would have been on the 6th, and it was flashback back to April of 2005 and concerned the police violence, the Santa Cruz police and UCSC police violence against students and other participants in the Tent University that happened at the base of campus. And it was really quite wrenching, and I think I was more of a narrator at the time, and I kind of kept myself cool, but it seemed to me to be very important to convey a lot of that information, and I hope that people took it in, because that's what the Santa Cruz police, you know, the beneficent Santa Cruz police, the same Santa Cruz police that's here today, did, gosh, I guess it was 17 and a half years ago, with no real change in policies that I'm aware of in terms of pain compliance holds and so forth. I think carotid artery holds have been stopped or something, or supposedly stopped. But you don't get any real clarity on what kinds of people are being detained, what the causes are for, what kind of actual charges result, who's making the complaints, who the police are actually serving, how much it's all costing in terms of all the endless whack-a-mole sweeps of homeless folks that don't have a lot of reports of sweeps happening recently, but that may be because we're simply not going out to get them. I mean, I hold meetings and put out my phone number and I ask questions here and there and I do the occasional interviews, as you're going to hear, but it's not the systematic one. Never really has been systematic, but I would say more numerous contacts I used to have years ago. Although there is an opportunity for people to report. If you want to go to the Food Not Bombs meal, you'll find my bulletin board, or the bulletin board. It was originally for Union of the Homeless when there was at least a pretense of the Union of the Homeless, or I guess to be generous, we could say the Union of the Homeless is in an inactive phase at this time, which is, I say it with a slight ironic smile, but not entirely. I mean, the Union of the Homeless has got activists connected with it like Keith McHenry, who are very committed, I think, to basic civil rights for homeless people, although his priorities are feeding homeless people and, of course, making a free speech statement as well as filling bellies that way. So it's hard to say what kind of sweeps are happening. I might have more information for you on Sunday, and if you have more information for me or for the community, please call me and I will pass it on, 831-423-4833 or 831-423-HUFF. If you still have one of those old phones, I guess it's even the new phones have the letters on the along with the numbers. So let's begin with J.C. Orton. J.C. Orton is kind of, you'll hear me describing who he is. I played the occasional interview with him in the past. He's an activist who primarily now is connected with social services in Berkeley, California, up north in the Bay Area, where he distributes money to some 20 disabled individuals. He's their conservator, so to speak, and apparently that's one of the few ways you can get the kind of disability they get, although he seemed to have a hard time answering that question for me. You can judge for yourself. We talk a lot about the specifics of how Berkeley is going after COVID, and yet didn't talk much about the crackdown on sweeps. I rarely get information on sweeps from JC, but usually I get it elsewhere in People's Park and at the Here There encampment. Where Did We Go came and went. That's another encampment called Where Do We Go. And other activists who live in their vehicles haven't gotten much information from them lately. May have an interview of a brief kind with Wes White. We'll see if that works. And let's get to J.C. Orton.
Let's talk to Alistair. You were on the phone there with her earlier, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm in the car here with J.C. Orton, who is a tireless or very tired or both worker for the Catholic Worker and for the homeless folks, many of them here in Berkeley. Today is the 7th of October. And, J.C., you've...
November.
Thank you. Only a month of difference. Why quibble over months? Thank you. Actually, I've been making that mistake more frequently. You've been doing this now for, what, 20 years?
When we hit Thanksgiving, we will be having our 25th anniversary.
And we, of course, is the Catholic Worker.
Yes, that's it. Exactly, yes.
And you are both a, one would call you a serious religious student or our worker.
Yes.
A believer, if you will, if nothing else.
Very much so, yes.
As well as being someone who is not merely a Jesuit, used in the negative sense of the word, who is engaged in high-flown theological debates, but you're out there on the streets every day dealing with the resources which pass through your hands to go to homeless folks. And for you, not much in the way of monetary recompense.
Well, I'm not in it for the money. I'm in it because it's what gives value to my life. That's one of the things that makes me one of the richest people in the world, because I have many, many people that care about me and many people that I care about, and that is the true richness that is valuable.
Now, this caring that you feel, is this the kind of caring that reduces you to tears if these individuals get into accidents or die? Is it a more distant caring which you feel for the person, but you don't emotionally respond to their misfortunes? How would you characterize your caring?
Well, when I go in and emotionally respond, I do it from a positive aspect rather than one where I'm worrying about this or mourning about that. I try to find the best out of it. And when things do get a bit crazy out there on the streets and there are things that happen, I don't respond in anger or with violence or using any of the crazy expletives that one uses when you're telling people that you don't like them or you don't like what they do. And try to keep it positive. Use that positive angle on everything. And sometimes it's a bit of an effort, but the more effort you put into it, the better it is.
I'm going to kind of follow up on that subject in a moment, but first let me clarify for those who haven't heard the earlier interviews I've done with you, and who knows, I do so many interviews that they've probably gotten lost in the shuffle. But some may remember. Give us an example of a typical day for you.
Well, I get up at about 5 in the morning, and I load the car up with a couple of sleeping bags, clothing, socks, my little goodie boxes of different foods and whatnot. Two big monstrous mailboxes of mail, as I run a mail service for the folks. And then the people that I do money management for, I have to bring an envelope of all and a receipt book so I can keep track of everything. Then I come out at I hit the spot there up on Shattuck Avenue at 7 o'clock and stay out there for 2 hours and work with all the people. They know that those are the hours that I'm going to be out there on Monday and on Tuesday and on Wednesday and on Thursday and on Friday and on Saturday. And I rarely, if ever, take a day off Monday through Saturday, bringing all this different depth of resource. And the fact they've got somebody they can talk to and try to get some help with it, whatever it happens to be, being out there. And then on Sunday, we do that big breakfast. I have to get a little bit earlier, and I'm able to go and get other people to take care of putting together three percolators full of coffee and hot chocolate. Another gentleman that goes and takes care of putting together the hot cereals now, three giant pots, two oatmeals and one grits, and then lots and lots of things that you can put on top of that rather than just a bowl of cereal. That we have raisins and brown sugar and granola and all sorts of different things. So it makes it a very pleasant meal rather than just, a cookie and that's it. And, we have three different drinks. We have hot chocolate, we have coffee, we have milk, and we also bring out fruit juice.
No brandy?
No. People wonder, well, maybe when it's New Year's Day, you guys could bring out all sorts of stuff. And it's, no, we're not going to do that. There's too much problem with alcohol with too many people out there. And,
Sacramental wine, perhaps?
No, I don't bring anything like that out.
Now, this is not dependent upon people's religious beliefs, of course. You're not requiring them to, confess or join in Catholic services. That's not your objective.
Well, that's part of it. Before we have the meal on Sunday, we have I make an announcement about what's happening in the week and if we're going to have any new resources or anything additional coming out. And then we gather together, both the workers and the people that we're feeding, we gather together, and we thank God for the help of getting the food and the energy and everybody out here together, so we're able to take care of one another. So very important. We don't just do it just us. It's a much larger body that we're talking about. And then at the end of the meal, we have it at two locations. When we go to our second meal, we do the first meal at People's Park, and the second meal in downtown Berkeley behind the City Hall. And after that, we have a gathering where we pull out from all of our workers and get them to share their experience at the meal and what they've been doing for the last week and perhaps what their plans are to do within the next few days or a few weeks or whatever it may be, and put different challenges out there and sharing all the things that that we have the capability of doing. And since we are out there and caring, then we have the responsibility of taking those assets out there and doing so much, getting to know the people and getting them to know you. Sort of the old adage about you show me yours, I'll show you mine. But in showing and being shown, we're talking about understanding the people and having them understand us. And it makes it a very personal situation. So the social aspect of what we're doing is so very important, way beyond just the things that we bring out.
But there is no requirement for people to have particular views or join in particular rituals to eat or to receive those survival activities stuff.
Oh, we don't force feed it on them. No, it's not like that.
So how many people would you say you serve a day?
Well, in the mornings, anywhere from, on a real light day, maybe 8 or 10, sometimes as much as 20. But then on Sunday, the numbers are much, much larger than that. On a very slow Sunday, where it's rainy or it's just some different whatever it is, maybe only 20 or 30 people at the very minimum, all the way up to maybe 110, 130 sometimes. And then when we do some of the holiday meals where we bring out fried chicken and all sorts of tasty foods, the numbers there are somewhere between 70 and 100. So it's very effective, and people know that they're being cared for and that they're not going to be left out in the cold and left hungry, because we're out there on a consistent basis, day after day after day. We just don't come out on a holiday here and a holiday there. In fact, we usually don't come out on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas, because all sorts of other locations are taken care of, because there's all sorts of other groups that want to go and do things on those days. So, strangely as it may sound, we actually take off Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day and don't do a meal, although the people are cared for because, gratefully, there are different groups that come out and like hit those holidays, those particular holidays. But we realize it's much more important to do it on a consistent day-after-day basis rather than just trying to hit a special day here or a special day there or working on just a birthday. I mean, we're alive for 365 days a year, and to just celebrate just the one day and take the rest of the year and not give it any focus is, well, it's opportunity. So we move forward on all that. And they know that they are cared for, and the connection, it becomes very personal after a while. We get to know them so well, they get to know us so well. And from time to time, there's depth of risk, and other times we end up taking care of really tough challenges that are out there. And it's very satisfying to see people warm up from so many different things, not just from us giving them sleeping bags or tents.
What kind of a salary or sustenance do you get for doing this, let's say, on a monthly basis?
Well, as I just told you, I have the ability, I have the luck of being one of the richest people in the world, because the riches are based on a different angle from the people that I care about and that I love and the people that love us because of what we're doing. And that's the true example of what
it's not
based on dollars.
I mean, I agree with you, but also it's, you're not paying your rent with richness, and your rent gets paid somehow, your monthly food bill gets paid somehow. How much are you in fact getting as a steady income that can allow you to live in a house, because you're not outside, you live in a building, you run a vehicle. So what would you say your monthly income is that essentially sustains this operation?
Well, I have the one, and that is because I'm well into my 70s, I get a Social Security benefit, which is a minimal one, because I started getting it when I was before you ended up with that magic number, whatever it was back in those days. I think you had to be 66 or 67 to get a full benefit. So I have that, and then I get paid for distributing the street spirit, and that's all the income I have. And I have to be very careful, and then occasionally people that know about what we're doing will come and help us. And there was this guy that I bumped into earlier today that slipped me a $20 bill to help me out.
Huh, you get paid off, eh? So, JC, again, I guess I miss a little of that. You have, forgive me for being so meretricious and monetarily focused. What's the average expense that allows you to continue doing this day after day, week after week, month after month? You, of course, would say the love of Jesus, the love of man. Of course, these are important things, perhaps. But there's also a very earthly element, which is why you handle homeless people's money, for instance, and don't say, go thou out and seek Jesus, instead of, let's say, wisely spending your money.
Well, when I manage other people's money for people that are housed, I make sure that their rents are paid on time and that I meter out the money that they get from Social Security over a month's period, you know, by seeing them. I make myself daily available if they need to get a little bit of money for this or a little bit of money for that, to make sure the money lasts the whole month rather than just giving a big slug of money on the first day of the month and then potentially not having any money towards the end of the month. So there's lots of different...
Is this court-ordered or...?
Well, it's done through the Social Security system. I've been doing that for over 25 years now.
Well, does that mean that it's the people whose money you're distributing have a say in this, or are they required to go through you?
Well, if they are considered by the Social Security system of not getting the money directly, but having it run through somebody, which they call a rep payee, to make sure that all the money is spent well, because if you give somebody that is on the sticks, they're homeless perhaps, and they're having difficulties with this and that, you give them a $1,100...
Whereas the wealthy, let us say, are very well deal with their money in a much more circumspect way and a much more socially beneficial approach and help themselves and do not fall into these problems. Would you agree with that, my son?
Yes, but the key thing with us and the way I manage their money is making sure the money lasts the whole month. Mm-hmm. rather than just giving a big slug of money on the first, which one of the rules that I have when I take somebody on as a repayee, I said, I have one golden rule. And they say, what's that? And he says, well, the way I do it is you always have a dollar in your pocket.
Let me ask you,
what does that mean? What that means is the money will be metered out through the month.
Let me ask you, though, JC, again, you're not really answering my question, which is, how many people have to do this because they're mandated to do it and they won't get the money otherwise, and how much feel that they have this agreement with you, they think it's a wise thing for them to do with you, and therefore they appreciate this service? Or are they, in fact, likely to throw bricks through your window, for instance, if problems develop?
Well, sometimes there are people that just have a lot of difficulties, and they end up being violent, so you try to work around that the best you can. But like I said, making sure that they can stay with a dollar in their pocket is very important.
You're still not answering my question.
Well, what's the specific question?
The question is, how many do this voluntarily, and how many do it because they have no other choice? That is to say, they wouldn't be getting the money if it didn't go through you.
Because Social Security is the one that puts the limitation on it. Because you are receiving Social Security because you are disabled, which is with almost all the people that I manage for, Social Security knows there's some difficulty with those people, the disability to be able to handle their money correctly, or perhaps handling it very poorly, spending it on what I would call not wholesome expenditures, you know, drugs and different things and alcohol. And by going and metering the money out over an extended period for a whole month, then they have money to some degree. And eventually, we try to get them into subsidized housing, and at that point, their cost for their housing runs about $250 to $300 for their share of costs, and at that point, they're eating.
However, generally speaking, this is not a voluntary procedure. They are mandated to go to you if they want to get their money at all. Is that correct?
They're mandated to have a middleman managing their money, so the money will last the whole month. And if they can finally find housing through subsidies and whatnot, that the expenses of all these things are taken care of. A lot of our people have storage units.
They spend
$100 or $150 a month for a storage unit, and if they don't pay for that on an ongoing basis,
I understand all that, JC. You're attempting to I think pretty up what's going on here, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be prettied up. But I'm saying that the reality is they have to essentially declare themselves incompetent to handle money.
No, it's not that. It's Social Security makes that decision based on the difficulty.
Basis?
Well, Social Security makes the basis.
And in order to get Social Security, do they have to declare themselves disabled?
Well, they are seen that way, where they have a doctor or something say this person is incapable of taking care of themselves, and at that particular point, almost always at that point, the people that I work are homeless, and then we try to make the step up to try to find subsidized housing, which only costs them a small fraction of their money.
Accurately speaking, because you have been dealing with these folks for many years,
yes,
and a number of them, probably over 100.
Well, I've done more than 100 people over the years. Right now, I only have 16 that I'm currently working on. I've never had, you know, more than about 20 at any one time.
I see.
But I've followed them from the very beginning. Sometimes some get married. Sometimes they get they have a child. And sometimes they pass away. So I have to deal with all the different bits and pieces in their lifestyle.
I'm confusing your work with the Street Spirit Distributors, of which you have had hundreds of people doing distribution, or at least scores of people, sometimes more than 100, distributing the Street Spirit newspaper.
Okay, well, with regard to the Street Spirit has a number of different angles to it that perhaps are not noticed by people. Why are you selling Street Spirit? And one of the things that they do is they get a certain depth of income. They get their $2 for the paper, but after a while they get to know people in different areas where they stand around and are selling Street Spirit. And some of their, I would say, their regular clientele, they don't give them $2. Maybe it's a 5-spot or a 10-spot. And especially during Thanksgiving and Christmas time, I'm always told by different people that are selling the Street Spirit, sometimes they get much more than a $5 bill or a $10 bill. There's usually a handful of three or four that get as much as $100 for selling the Street Spirit. And the connection, it becomes a personal connection with their regular customers. and it becomes a social angle rather than just dollars.
Yes, of course, the street spirit does talk about homeless circumstances and lets the ordinary non-homeless, non-poor person often understand some of what's happening in Berkeley and around the state around homeless people. At least that's the way it used to be when I was writing for Street Spirit. But again, it's more than 100 people who are your normal, or have been in the past prior to the COVID, the normal number of distributors of Street Spirit?
Well, the people that distribute the Street Spirit, most of the people that I take care of the distribution to them, most of them are homeless. And I'd say maybe 20% at the very best have either subsidized housing or might actually be living inside where they have a regular rental, as the case may be.
Couch surfing.
Yes, couch surfing and everything else, and sleeping out in people's park. And
living in a car.
Well, if the car is expensive, you got to go and feed it all the time with gas, and you have to find a place to park it. And
I'm not saying it's a luxury to live in a car, although it is for some.
But if you have enough to take care of that, then you could actually live in
it. How many people would you estimate distribute Street Spirit that you contact on a monthly basis compared with, let's say, a few years ago?
Well, right now there's about somewhere between 50 and 70 that are actively selling the Street Spirit that both myself and Alistair come into contact with.
She's the editor, Alistair Boone.
Yes.
And before, let's say, in 2019 or 2018?
It was larger. We would be right around the 100 mark. But part of it has changed in the last 2 or 3 years because of the problem with the epidemic. And during that period of time, when we weren't distributing the papers whatsoever at all, the Street Spirit bosses managed to find some, they raised some money, and instead of going and giving people papers, because they weren't doing that at all, they collected money and gave each of the different people that were Street Spirit vendors, they gave them a $200 pop. In the absence of giving them anything.
$200 for an absence of Street Spirit for a total of, what, 3 months or something?
They did a couple of them, yes. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to do that because you couldn't make any money if the Street Spirit was not being published, and also there was the depth of risk out there. The more you're out there, the better the chances of getting exposed. So all this was done as a response to being able to take care of those people that... prior to the COVID, was using this as the major share of their income.
What was the fatality or illness rate that you would attribute directly to COVID during this period of time among homeless folks? Any sense of that?
A very, very small, maybe 1 or 2%, and that's a guesstimate. Of the people that I came in contact with during all this period, I only knew 3 people that got the bug. Nobody that got killed, but 3 people that had the COVID, and they managed to survive, which was very satisfying.
How many people would you say that you've come into contact with on a regular basis get other illnesses that lay them low who are homeless?
Well, that wouldn't be the COVID. That would just be all the different things.
I've flu, had people, cancer, you name it.
I have people that have that. I have people that... that have, with problems with HIV, people that don't have, they're not having an immune system that makes you exposed to so much.
But during the same period that these 3 people who got COVID, you noted, how many would you say you noted got other illnesses?
There are some. People have their aches and pains. I mean,
what's your estimate?
I don't know. I couldn't give that a number.
We're trying to talk about the vulnerability of people outside to illness compared to...
Well, they're sleeping outside. It's cold outside, and they get wet in the rain. Like most of us, we just climb inside the house and stay warm. We can go inside and we can take a shower if we after a day of running around doing this and that. And when you don't have access to all these different facilities to stay hygienically clean and
indeed,
healthy and whatnot, it goes and makes you more at risk for different illnesses.
Looking at it from another perspective, how many people in the last 3 years of the COVID pendency who are not homeless, who are your colleagues, your friends, just your business associates, would you say got ill that you became aware of that had COVID?
Maybe a half dozen.
And would you say that's because, but you regularly have at least as much association with unhoused people as you do with housed people. Is that fair to say or not?
Yes.
And so, in effect, it seems those who are unhoused seem to be more, and this was the case, by the way, in Santa Cruz, too, I think, less susceptible to a COVID illness and more susceptible, those who are housed.
Well, that's great that it was like that, because we don't want people to be taken out early because this virus is floating around and nails you, and because you are weak or not as strong as if you were living inside and warm and everything else, and healthy and eating healthy food and all the other things that you need to
but
stay
healthy.
But you
found that was true, though. Did
yes.
You think, yeah.
Yes.
Now, you know, I guess I initially had the thought that, well, the people you're handling money for are those who have, in essence, been declared either the Social Security system required them to, in essence, find evidence that they were disabled. I've been concerned about this because recently, and I also asked you regarding the issue of whether there were religious requirements to have your services, that is to say, to have your food services, your whatever other clothing and other things you present to folks on, or the street service opportunities, street spirit opportunities. I was assuming you don't make this is there's no religious requirement to do this.
Well, there is a religious requirement to do this. We must care about those people around us, not just the people that are blood
you
related.
You make a you say hold it, hold it. I'm not going to feed you unless you care about other people. Is that what you're telling me? You say you've got to read
everybody.
This book for here's the Bible. You got to read. I don't think you're saying
you
that.
Need to care about everybody, not just the people that are nice or wonderful.
Are you requiring that to get food services? Is my question, and you have not been answered. I mean, I know you the answer, but I just want you to answer.
Well, since we've been out there for such a long time, people know that we're going to be out there with the resources that we bring out and many different types of resources.
Regardless of their views, regardless of their willingness to perform services, regardless of how much they love their fellow human being. Is that correct?
Well, sometimes there's a lot of distraction as far as the love part. There's a lot of anger out there.
You're not answering my question, JC.
They don't have wonderful things that we
Why
have.
Are you ducking the question? I don't understand. In other words, it seems to me a simple question. The answer is, no, we don't require you to do anything to get the food. We would love you for you to care about other people. We urge you
no,
to do
we
that.
We don't require them to do anything. We bring it out to them because they have a need.
I assume that's
the case. To take care of the different resources that are out there and make sure that it is redistributed by people that have those excess resources that can go and flow it out. And we're happy to be part of that distribution.
That's
and it's
good.
Not distribution of resource, it's the distribution of care.
Of course, the distribution of resources compared to the actual excess resources is, you would certainly agree, minuscule.
Well, the whole thing, it's a package deal. You give out personal resources, the moments, the time that you can give out, and whether it's food or clothing or when you can find housing for them through the different subsidized housing agencies, we have this responsibility to take care of one another.
Would you agree that the actual resources available in Berkeley, a wealthy community in part, certainly, far exceeds what actually is being distributed to those who need it in Berkeley?
Well, what's out there is good. There's never going to be quite enough to take care of everybody, and moving from a homeless situation to a house situation is a giant step if you've been out there and homeless for a long period of time. You can't just step back into a housing situation. It's something I've been experiencing
Are you telling me that
for a long time.
Are you telling me the existing situation, the existing wealth in Berkeley, if it were fairly distributed, would not serve the people who are currently in need here adequately?
Well, it's going to take more than housing. It's going to take the additional emphasis of care beyond just the housing.
But it would probably take the housing as well.
Yes, of course it would take that as well.
It's available, you're saying, but it's not being used.
Well, the amount that's available, but it's limited to some degree. And to have your own apartment and have your own bathroom and your own kitchen, I mean, that's great. But if you're just stuck in like a tiny house where it doesn't necessarily have the same depth, sometimes it's just not enough, especially if when you were younger, you were exposed to having all of these luxuries, if you follow me.
Necessities.
Yes.
Of course. So I guess what I'm saying is that, and I'm not trying to demean or limit or suggest that what you're doing is, well, it is inadequate, obviously, to meet the need. And and that is because of the fact that resources are hoarded increasingly by those in power and those in the upper class, in my view. You may not share that view. I don't think all Catholics do. Some do, I think. But I don't know what the story is with you. But I guess in Berkeley, well, I guess what I really want to ask you, I might want to ask you now is how things are going in Berkeley after this COVID. What has been the change in the situation here in terms of how people are treated? We've known they've demolished some of the encampments without providing lots of alternatives. Some alternatives were provided in order to get people to lure people out of People's Park. You know, they set up this 3-year hotel thing, I believe, or maybe it's a 1.5-year hotel thing, I'm not sure. But what's your sense about the impact of the end of COVID here in for homeless folks or for folks outside?
Well, the need to take care of one another continues whether we have COVID, whether we have homelessness, whether we have illness, whether we have we don't worry about situations such as the cost of everything going up to the roof. We still need to take care of one another, and that should be part of the way we take care of ourselves. When we get together and we have kids, we take care of our children, and once the kids get to be in their 20s or 30s, then we have to send them through high school and into college, if we can do that, and help them make that next step further along in their lives. But to do this for people that we're not related to, that we choose to take the responsibility of those people that nobody has enough time or effort or money to take care of, trying to get society to see the depth of responsibility we have for everybody, not just the people that we are in love with and that we are tight with. The need is always going to be out there, and the important thing is that we do respond to that need.
Do you find people responding more, less, about the same over the course, let's say, of the last 5 years?
Well, because of the COVID, it sort of shook up things and made things difficult. But I think it's allowed more people to see there's some great needs to be that need to be addressed. And I'm happy to be part of that. And I'm very happy that over the last just 2 or 3 years, it's picked up a lot. And we have more people that are sort of chiming in and saying, well, let's get involved with this, let's get involved with that. And it just it doesn't have to be in our group. It's just that all of society needs to be taking care of all of society rather than just their own tight people that they're tight and connected with, because we have to take care of one another. It's the whole world. It's not just our little group.
Have you seen an increase in this recently, a decrease, pretty much still the same? What's your sense?
The increase as far as the response, I think that's definitely what's been happening. And the need is keeps growing and growing. If we have this problem with our climate change that's coming up and around the corner here, and we have different problems with the cold weather and the hot weather and the winds and all the different things that could perhaps come along.
The occasional nuclear war.
Yes. Well, we have to take care of one another, because there is much more to it than just the time that we spend down here on Earth. So if we do the good things for ourselves, when we finally make that break from life to death, we want to make sure that's a positive transaction.
So your theory presupposes a life after death. And for those who wouldn't believe in a life after death, there would seem to be little motivation to engage in this kind of human love unless they had some other reason to do it.
Well, we try to take care of them even after they're gone.
What do you mean by that?
Well, pray for them. Remember them. And as use that as an example to teach others to step forward and to care for one another. So very important that we do that.
Now, are you suggesting that taking care of someone after they're gone by praying for them and suggesting that other people remember them and follow their example is helpful to a person once they're gone?
Yes, I do.
And how would that be the case?
By so many different ways it's done. not just what you pray for them, but the fact you take that energy that you can't do for those people that are gone, take the energy and the resources that you have, and you take that forward and you help the people that have not reached that point of where they're about ready to pass on.
But how does that help the people who are gone?
Well,
I mean, it helps other people. It helps you. But how does it help the people who have left?
Because there's the transition between life and death and the afterlife. And if you understand that to a better degree, it starts to click.
So you have a personal experience with this transition?
Yes. Well, I lost my son here 2 years ago. He was only 32 years of age. And I could have chosen, do more than that, that he was gone. Well, yes, he was gone, but where or what is happening to him? Is he just when he got killed by getting hit by a car? Was that it? Was that just the end of the story? No, because something goes on beyond just the fact of life when you go into the death, because your soul, that stuff that's within you, not the physical stuff, but the emphasis of divinity within you, needs to pick up. And if he wasn't ready to make the final jump, if you follow me, then he needs help from us, and we work on it, and we pray for him, and we do good, and basically move those brownie points forward into his situation. And as I look at it, if we do that and we're successful, when he gets there, I think you understand what I mean by there, hopefully he'll be up there when it's my turn to go up there. He'll be standing there at the gate and say, hey, come on in.
So, in other words, again, you are suggesting that your own, it's hard to talk about your experience yourself. It's hard for me to comment on your experience grappling with the reality of someone very close to you who has died, particularly prematurely, particularly someone you've loved and spent years and years with. That is something that it seems inappropriate even for me to even mention this. Because I talk in abstractions, and abstractions are not what this person was or is to you. That's not, the person is far from an abstraction.
Well, if you had had a child, or you had adopted somebody, or took on a great responsibility for another person, then you would perhaps see that, because you'd have that that constant focus of things
right.
that needed to be done.
But I am talking about, this is something that people experience, that death, as a natural course of part of life. And it happens to all of us. And so that's why I ask you about your personal experience when you talk about it. It benefits other people that you pray for them. It benefits them, not just you, but them. And your suggestion, I guess, is this based simply on a series of beliefs that people have an afterlife, that they are waiting in some heavenly area? Is it based upon that solely, or is there something else? Because many of us don't share those beliefs, as you know. Are there other reasons, other feelings you have, other aspects you would say that it benefits this person? In other words, I advise you, Robert, when someone dies you really care about, that you pray for them, or that somebody else pray for them, because that's going to benefit them. That is to say, them, not being the person who's praying, but the person who died.
Yes,
and this is
right.
A very technical question for you.
Yes, that's right. That does have a great emphasis on it. And it can, at the very least, it could change the way that you are and what you do personally for yourself by extending out that depth of love that you carry with you and spreading out to where it impacts a much, much larger group.
But how would it help them? See, that's my question.
Well, it does help them.
Well, if they're...
Something that happens with time.
But if they're gone, why would they be, how would they be helped over time?
Well, because at that point when they die, you have the two items. You have their soul and you have their body. And obviously at the end of it, their body gets cremated or gets buried in a coffin and put down in the dirt. But their soul, the emphasis of who they are inside, that's what makes the movement. And that eventually, as they progress and get closer and closer to getting to heaven, they get reconnected with their body. And that's a bit hard to explain to some people that don't understand that or have not been exposed to it, but still.
Well, you have been exposed to it because otherwise, presumably, you wouldn't be believing this. I know you do, but that would presuppose, I would think, that you've been exposed to these experiences that lead you to talk about a thing called a soul, a thing called heaven. What experiences, if you wish to say, have you had that lead you to speak about these terms and the way you do?
By doing the good that I do, lets me understand. And by doing the good that I do, and the good that I teach others and instruct others and show others and I do with others, this fills my heart. It fills my soul with the warmth and allows me to understand and helps me do what I'm doing, no matter how tired I am of this or that. It gives me that energy, and it recharges my batteries on a constant basis. There's the rain.
Indeed. I certainly have seen how your batteries have gone low and then been recharged, so I can't deny that your energy is, you've described today, how you take fantastically long walks that I couldn't even imagine taking, you know, as a matter of course. So, I mean, that's a reality. I guess the question again, in which I to me is still unanswered, which has to do with your particular experience. I don't see how this has anything to do with soul or heaven, in terms of, in other words, what I ask you is, when you use these terms, do these relate back to a particular experience you had at a particular moment in your life that. It's true, you're saying that every time you do these good things, you feel energized. You feel you're passing on something, and you're
very
also...
Very simplistic way of putting it. Yes, that's true.
You know, and energized not just in a, gosh, you know, I'm taking energy pills, but in a meaningful way that reassures and heals you.
It doesn't go and energize my body. It energizes my soul.
But you can
charged up.
You can talk about yourself as a combination of,
yes,
of whatever you are. It energizes that of you. And so you're defining part of yourself as this part of this term soul.
Yes.
And what experience have you had with this particular aspect of yourself that you wish to comment on, if you do? It's a personal sort of thing. You're dealing with an atheist here. So, I mean, that might not be the kind of thing you might want to talk about. But if you did, here's your big chance.
Well, we lead good lives. We extend ourselves beyond our own little warm bubble of life, because if we're only taking care of ourselves and only accumulating stuff and things and riches, the key to it is one has to change their focus if they want to. A very simplistic way of putting it together is you want to work on your retirement benefits, if you think about this, and you put those emphasis on important things. Let me see what this call's all about.
You may be coming in with some more important things at this point. I've been talking with, because this man has to get back to work, whether it's for the souls of others around him, for his own soul, or just to help people, body and soul. Any final thoughts, JC?
Well, you end up getting help because you're reaching out and giving to others your time, your efforts, your resources. It's in giving that you receive. And the more you give of yourself, your time, your sweat, and your energy, your dollars, whatever it happens to be, you give it away. It's not just a matter of giving it away, but putting it in a better place. This helps other people and allows them to move along in a better situation.
And some people can completely agree with that and have no conception of an afterlife, heaven, or the soul, you know.
Well, it'll catch up with them at some point. Whatever is happening, and hopefully they have enough brownie points that they are able to make that step forward from life to death to afterlife. Give that some thought. It might shake you up a little bit, but after you have examined that a bit and explored it a bit and said, well, wow, maybe I ought to give that a shot.
We'll have to talk further. Thank you. We've been talking with?
Okay. JC.
Thank you, JC.
Okay. Take care, Robert.
You too, man.
young babies are suffering from malnutrition. And I say that we don't want no nuclear war. With nuclear war, we won't get far. No, I say that we don't want no nuclear war. With a nuclear war, we won't get far. So no, just hold on pause. Yeah.
That was Peter Tosh, No Nuclear War. So my regular expeditions up to Berkeley almost always involve J.C. Orton, because he's the... He's the main distributor, or the distributor, of Street Spirit for the Bay Area. And Street Spirit, this issue, had an unusual number of articles that attracted my interest. One of them is the Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers Win Settlement in Court, and I'm going to read you some of that now. But if you want to look at some of the other articles in more depth, I suggest you check out Street Spirit, which you can buy from the occasional homeless vendor in Santa Cruz. There aren't many of them. Two regularly attend HUF meetings, and there is usually an issue in the Berkeley Library. At least I left one there today. And you can also get one by contacting me on the HUF line at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And most of the articles in this issue are available online, which is helpful, too, for all of you computer-savvy folks, which is a large majority of housed people these days. And that's some of you out there, for sure. Anyway, I'm going to read a bit of this. This was an article written as a commentary by Berkeley Copwatch, and it's called Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers Win Settlement in Court. The group's victory will change the city's municipal code. Still, anti-homeless parking laws persist. After a year of litigation, 10 Berkeley residents who live in vehicles have won a settlement from the city. The settlement makes two small but significant changes to Berkeley's municipal code, both of which have the potential to improve quality of life for people who live in vehicles. This win is a part of a larger wave of unhoused people across California using the courts to defend the rights of unhoused people, a trend cited in an ACLU report last year titled Outside the Law, the Legal War Against Unhoused People. In Berkeley, after a huge crackdown by the city against residents living in their vehicles, 10 individuals from the Berkeley Friends on Wheels community chose to fight back with a lawsuit. The group did not have a lawyer, with some volunteer legal support, and this to me is very important, they studied up and represented themselves in court. In the weeks leading up to a sweep planned for September 30th, 2021, city outreach workers routinely warned residents that Berkeley would soon begin enforcing all applicable laws. The parking regulations in Berkeley, as we have written about before, make it almost impossible to live in a vehicle. While there was enforcement of these ordinances, it had slowed with the start of COVID-19. But by September 2021, officials were ready to crack down again, despite the fact that pandemic conditions continued. Under the threat of having their homes towed, 10 unhoused neighbors, residents of the Friends on Wheels vehicle community, filed a lawsuit against the city of Berkeley. The lawsuit cited constitutional rights violations, violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, among others. After a year of litigation, the 10 plaintiffs of the Friends on Wheels lawsuit won a settlement with the city of Berkeley. While not all their demands were met, the lawsuit did effectively put a pause on vehicle evictions for over 6 months while the city was publicly challenged in court. Each plaintiff was afforded $1,500 to be used for vehicle home repairs and registration. The eventual settlement also included changes to the Berkeley Municipal Code. Through a carefully written and powerfully argued case, in addition to mountains of collected documents and testimony, the Friends on Wheels case made legislative change and moved the needle slightly away from anti-homeless policy. There were two changes to the Berkeley Municipal Code, the BMC, one of which was to repeal Chapter 12.76 on house cars. It stated that no person shall use or occupy or permit the use or occupancy of any house, car, or camper for human habitation within the city for more than 3 days in a 90-day period. That's Berkeley Municipal Code BMC 12.76.020. It's interesting because this code is quite reminiscent of what was used to go after food servers. It's a state law that says you cannot serve food except out of a certified kitchen for a group of people outside for more than 3 times in 90 days, which, of course, Food Not Bombs and other groups working in Santa Cruz and other areas, many of us ignored because people needed to be fed and it was outrageous, obviously intended to deter the visible poverty being shown, which embarrassed politicians in the various cities where it was enforced. In any case, continuing with the story about the Berkeley vehicle dwellers and their victory, while people were rarely cited for this old municipal code, it was also vaguely written, meaning enforcement of the ban was historically selective, targeting poor and unhoused residents in Berkeley. The plaintiffs also earned a huge win with amendments made to BMC 14.40.120, the so-called oversized vehicle overnight ban, OVS, OSV. This ordinance banned the parking of oversized vehicles between the hours of 2 a.m. and 5 a.m., somewhat similar to the Santa Cruz ordinance, which failed to make muster at the Coastal Commission. And I'm not sure if the Berkeley ever took any of their issues to the Coastal Commission, their ordinances, though Berkeley is in part on the coast, or at least it's on the bay, so I don't know, it might be within the Coastal Commission's jurisdiction and require that there be public access, and so that ordinances that criminalize people who live in their vehicles deny them access to the coast, and that might have been a consideration. I don't know. Perhaps one of these days I'll learn whether they address that issue, the folks who are thinking of challenging the law or not. Anyway, this is an ordinance that banned oversized vehicles between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. I think the one in Santa Cruz bans them from midnight to 5 or midnight to 6, but has not been enforced. Both the earlier ordinance, the Rochelle Naroyan ordinance, I call it, after the city council member who led the charge and 2015, and also the current ordinance. Maybe we can call it the Donna Myers Ordinance, I don't know, in Santa Cruz, which was put on hold because of lawsuits by the American Civil Liberties Union, Disability Rights Coalition, Democratic Socialists of America. I'm not sure if it was a Lifeboat or one of the affiliated groups that signed, that took the also took the issue, at least appealed the issue to the Coastal Commission. Continuing with this court case in Berkeley. The ordinance was actually amended in 2019 to explicitly include RVs and campers, even though they are not classified as commercial oversized vehicles. This amendment attempted to redefine the definition of an oversized vehicle, an OSV, and as the plaintiffs argued, a local statute cannot define commercial vehicles, as this is a matter of California, that is, state, as distinguished from local law. The city regulates the movement of vehicles, but it cannot alter its statutory definition. It sounds like a legal nitpicking to me, but if it works, go for it. The city of Berkeley should have never been able to alter the OSV definition. Because of this lawsuit, Berkeley has been held accountable. Hence, it had to pay $1,500. And, there were some other, apparently, victories in this settlement. Why do these wins matter? When people living on the street are evicted from their spot and have their belongings dumpstered, they do not often have a chance to respond, to have their complaints heard, to hold the city government responsible. It is incredibly hard to find lawyers to take up a case. Filing all the necessary paperwork for a lawsuit when your rights have been violated requires transportation, funds, access to computer and internet, and lots of time, among other things. This makes it incredibly easy for city governments to get away with violating the rights of unhoused people without any accountability or repercussions. None of the plaintiffs have yet received the $1,500 vehicle repair and registration stipend. Nor have any of the plaintiffs yet received coordinated entry assessment or reassessment as was agreed upon in the settlement. I think that means access to housing. That sounds like that's maybe what it means. Additionally, the harassment of the Friends on Wheels community, including more residents than just the 10 plaintiffs in this case, continues with additional four-hour parking signs posted on nearly every block in the area. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2022, in the early morning, four vehicles were towed as part of a larger effort by the city to purportedly, quote, clean, unquote, the area. What ensued was an eviction of many of the residents living in tents along 8th Street, north of Harrison Street in Berkeley. Two vehicle homes and two vehicles used for transportation to work were impounded. In the following days, as residents attempted to retrieve their vehicles, they were told by the tow yard that their vehicles, with their belongings still inside, had been destroyed as part of the agreement with the city. Unfortunately, the gains achieved from the recent settlement have not fundamentally changed the anti-houseless practices of the city of Berkeley and its so-called homeless response team. Get active. Be aware. Refuse to be abused. And that's by Berkeley Cop Watch. And it's, again, Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers win settlement in court. Group's victory will change the city's municipal code. Still, anti-homeless parking laws persist. And that's in Street Spirit of November 2022, which is available in the main library in Santa Cruz and online under thestreetspirit.com or .org. Try them both and see where you get. So this next musical break is compliments of the Byrds, singing group from the 60s. It's called I Come and Stand at Every Door. And I'm going to read you the lyrics, even though they're pretty intelligible. But just in case, I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent prayer. I knock and yet remain unseen, for I am dead, for I am dead. I'm only 7, although I died in Hiroshima long ago. I'm 7 now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by a swirling fire. My eyes grew dim, my eyes grew blind. Death came and turned my bones to dust, and that was scattered by the wind. I need no fruit. I need no rice. I need no sweets, nor even bread. I ask for nothing for myself, for I am dead. For I am dead. All that I ask is that for peace you fight today. You fight today, so that the children of this world may live and grow and laugh and play. So here's a story from the Disability Rights Advocates website. And they were, again, one of the plaintiffs who, well, they weren't really plaintiff, I guess, but they were the, I guess you call them, appellants. They appealed the OVO, the Oversized Vehicle Ordinance, along with the ACLU here in Santa Cruz, not in the courts, as I said before, but in the Coastal Commission, which so far has been good and at least holding off the technical enforcement of the Santa Cruz OVO law. But I'm hearing in Huff meetings that people are still getting tickets inside the coastal zone, even though the signs placed there have not been essentially passed by and given the imprimatur of legitimacy by the Coastal Commission, even the local Coastal Commission. And the local Coastal Commission says, we protest against this, but of course they're not doing any enforcement against the city to stop the harassment and the citation and ultimately the seizure of vehicles that can't afford to pay fines. Anyway, in Sevastopol, there's an ordinance that's similar to trying to displace residents living in their vehicles. At least I'm assuming it's similar. Let's read what their website says. This is from the October 25th, 2022. Sevastopol is a city on the north coast above San Francisco. Today, ACLU Foundation of Northern California, disability rights advocates, Legal Aid of Sonoma County, and the California Rural Legal Assistance, Inc., filed suit against the city of Sebastopol for enacting an ordinance that prohibits vehicles, quote, used for human habitation from parking anywhere within the city limits during the day. This action aimed at driving the city's most vulnerable residents out of town follows a decades-long and local and state failure to build affordable housing. Current listings for the smallest available apartments in Sebastopol approach an amount that is roughly equivalent to 100% of the monthly net income for a full-time worker making California's minimum wage. So you've got to pay all your wage for a month in order to get rent at the smallest available apartment in Sebastopol, according to this. As a result, many long-term Sebastopol residents have been priced out of the fixed housing, even though they may need to remain in the city to be near their families, jobs, schools, health care providers, and support networks. Unlike similar bans in other cities, the Sebastopol ordinance isn't based on concerns about traffic safety or vehicle size. So, for instance, they've claimed in Santa Cruz that it's a traffic safety if you have an oversized vehicle because it blocks the view of people turning onto the street, or it blocks the view of a sign. This is usually presented without any evidence that it's ever caused any problems, but it's a nice pretext to hang the law on, in my view. And I think the Coastal Commission, it was certainly argued by the ACLU and the Disability Rights Coalition, who were also, as I said, involved in this Santa Cruz suit against our OVO, or I should say the City Council's OVO law. The argument was pointed out that there's no evidence that they've presented. They just make these flat assertions and they expect the Coastal Commission to go along with them. And indeed, the local Coastal Commission, apparently in the jockstrap, if you will, of the city's staff, did go along with them. And that was until it was also pointed out that this would ban access to 54% of the city from anybody parking any time of day in a large vehicle, which immediately made it untenable even for those who were trying to work a way to get those damn homeless vehicles out of sight and out of town. So, anyway, the Sebastopol Ordinance, which says it targets vehicles designed or altered for human habitation, allowing police to enforce the ordinance in a discriminatory manner. Although the ordinance prohibits parking any vehicle in which a person could sleep, the city has made it clear they intend to enforce the ordinance only against people who are living in their vehicles or are considered otherwise undesirable. Sebastopol has not only failed to provide notice or guidelines for the police to prevent arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, the city has made it clear that it intends to enforce the ordinance only against people who have been the subject of complaints or whom the police deem undesirable, while giving wealthier residents a pass. This is discrimination, plain and simple, said Alicia Roman, staff attorney at California Rural Legal Assistance. I have not looked at the pleadings in this case. I'd be surprised if the city attorney or whoever cooked up this ordinance was stupid enough to say, we're only going to be targeting wealthier residents. But that could be, in fact, what is being done by the wording of the ordinance without using an explicit wealth criterion. And maybe I'll look at that at some point in the future. In addition to being discriminatory, Sebastopol's ordinance is uniquely punitive and enacts a one-strike-and-you're-out policy that calls for confiscating and impounding people's only means of shelter with the, wait for it, first citation. The threat of suddenly losing one's shelter is immensely stressful to people already struggling to maintain stability in their lives. Instead of working with the homeless and providing a reasonable solution, Sebastopol came up with a draconian one to ban homeless people living in their vehicles from the city, said Michael Deegan, a former resident of Sebastopol and one of the plaintiffs in the case. That is, one of the people who's living in an RV or is impacted by this ordinance. As a result, I was forced to move to Santa Rosa, where I had been assaulted by people and harassed by police. Sebastopol should overturn their RV ban and find another solution that is more humane and reasonable. Sebastopol officials' actions have made clear that they are more concerned with driving unhoused residents out of the city than providing meaningful solutions. In 2021, the City Council passed a resolution declaring the existence of a, quote, homeless emergency, unquote. According to the council, the emergency was not the human tragedy of community members being forced to live in vehicles. Rather, it was the existence of these vehicularly housed residents that it was, quote, impacting adjacent property owners, neighborhood businesses, and the general public. Impacting, you see. Illustrating this is the fact that Sevastopol provides almost no shelters for residents experiencing homelessness. Options are even more limited for unhoused Sevastopol residents with disabilities because the city has failed to provide accessible facilities. Many people who have lost their homes have only one alternative to sleeping unsheltered on the street, living in their vehicles. Sevastopol cannot continue to pass the buck on the regional housing crisis by pushing people living in their vehicles into neighboring communities. This approach is both cruel and counterproductive. To solve homelessness, Bay Area cities must work together to facilitate housing development and provide services and safe shelter to the unhoused, said Justin O'Milligan, homelessness prevention attorney at Legal Aid of Sonoma County. I can't disagree, but I'm not sure what that is going to do. Thomas Zito, supervising attorney at Disability Rights Advocates, said Sebastopol's failure to provide adequate affordable housing for its residents has disproportionate risk for our clients and others like them who are low-income people with disabilities who have been forced into housing of last resort, their vehicles. Living in an RV, car, or trailer is often much safer for people with disabilities than congregate shelters or living in a tent. Sebastopol cannot solve its housing crisis by driving unhoused people with disabilities out of town. And I'm not aware, for example, that in the recent Benchlands removal, which displaced hundreds and hundreds of people, there was any provision for people with disabilities up at the Armory and up at the Overlook next to the Armory, which was the go-to shelter that gave them the excuse, which claimed that they were providing alternatives, and so they were not, they said, the city said, City of Santa Cruz said, violating the Martin versus Boise court decision that says don't give them a ticket, don't prosecute them unless you have some kind of, and don't move them from where they are, unless you have some kind of real offer of alternative shelter that isn't discriminatory and is accessible and is indoors. Santa Cruz didn't have that. They lied about it. They did it anyway. And the entire Benchlands was demolished and now is a barren area with people sleeping wherever they can hide out. Or I guess their feet are sometimes poking out. Sebastopol's ordinance, getting back to Sebastopol, unlawfully attacks its most vulnerable residents, those who, because of economic circumstances and the city's own policy failures, have been forced to seek shelter by living in vehicles, said Walter Freeman, senior counsel of the ACLU of Northern California. It is not permissible for a city to address the crisis of homelessness by attempting to force unhoused people out of town. And that, again, is a from the web page of the Disability Rights Advocate. Civil rights groups sue the city of Sevastopol for the ordinance aimed at displacing residents living in their vehicle. So here's a bit more detail about this, the complaint that is being filled out. And we'll hopefully be seeing some complaints the next time the police move on anybody or threaten to move on anybody who is encamped in Santa Cruz. When they're not offering them adequate shelter, as is almost invariably the case. This case in Sebastopol involved David Allen Yesu, Michael W. Deegan, Paige, Elitza Corley, Jessica Marie Wetch, and the Sonoma County Acts of Kindness organization. Plaintiff Michael W. Deegan is 66 years old, currently lives in an RV outside of Sevastopol. He was previously employed as a commercial driver, but lost his license several years ago. If you're wondering what the sound is in the background, I'm actually downloading this complaint and the lawsuit just to make it available to those who want to read it, who don't have this kind of online opportunity that I do. Mr. Deegan has several disabilities, including a serious knee injury, severe depression, and other mental health disabilities and health conditions that put him at increased risk of complications from COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Because these disabilities prevent him from working, he currently lives on only $1,167.20 per month in benefit payments, far too little to afford fixed housing in Sevastopol. As a result, his RV is the only shelter available to him and the only place where he can maintain his belongings and feel safe. He moved to Sevastopol from Santa Rosa in 2018, living in an RV on Laguna Parkway and on Morris Street, was routinely harassed by police. He left Sevastopol after the passage of the HHV ordinance because he could not risk living there due to the threat of being ticketed and having his RV towed. I think that's the ordinance. They're talking about the oversized vehicle ordinance, perhaps. Mr. Deegan has a disability-related need to live in his RV rather than on the streets of Sevastopol or in a congregate shelter because of his mental health conditions and vulnerability to COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. He cannot live in a congregate setting, and he would be at a particular risk if forced to live unsheltered on the street. Living independently in his RV allows Mr. Deegan to manage his mental health conditions to protect himself from infectious disease. Losing the shelter, safety, and security his RV provides would be devastating to Mr. Deegan's physical and mental health. And this, of course, is a significant consideration here, this being at least one of the things that was mentioned here was the COVID crisis. The fact that these two prestigious legal organizations that are afraid of losing cases. They don't want to lose cases for various reasons. They're wasting their time and money. They're, of course, hurting their clients. And also they're creating a bad precedent, if they do, for possibly other people, other homeless folks who are living in RVs who are being harassed elsewhere in the state or elsewhere in the 9th district, which is the most of the western states, the far western states. So the fact that they're taking the case, even as COVID is ending, and they're still using the COVID-19 argument, among other things, means that that is still an argument that is they consider it viable. And that is one of the reasons that activists in Santa Cruz who had declarations and who had the opportunity to file in the benchland said they didn't want to do it because the COVID crisis is over, so they can't claim that COVID is a problem anymore. Well, that's not, in fact, the case. I mean, there are a lot of us who are skeptical of the dimensions of the COVID scare, who are skeptical of vaccines. Some are skeptical of vaccines. Some are skeptical of mandatory COVID vaccine mandates. But still, the reality is that insofar as this is still considered a health emergency, then the city and the county and the police departments are supposed to abide by it. And so are the attorneys, at least, to acknowledge that. And that's been one of, I've been really concerned that a lot of declarations have been gathered by the California Homeless Union and then not used. That really pissed me off. It still does, somewhat. So what some of us are doing at the Huff, which we don't claim to have the resources the Union of the Homeless has or that other groups may have, but we do, we have been trying to gather together people who are willing to make the kinds of complaints that Michael Deegan makes here in Sevastopol and take that to an attorney or just take it directly. You don't need an attorney. You can file it yourself if you have, if you simply put it out and fill out the proper papers. And that's something that some Huffsters have been working on. But with the demolition of the benchlands, the problem is and we do, and the failure of the city to actually act on specifically anti-homeless laws that are narrowly tailored to go after homeless people or particularly focused on homeless people, we don't have the same kind of target. So, for example, if you have a law, you have a law that criminalizes homeless people, and there actually is such a law. It's the camping ban in Santa Cruz called the Camping Services and Standards Ordinance. And, of course, the oversized vehicle ordinance as well, which isn't being enforced. But the city isn't using that ordinance. It is instead using other... it is simply frightening people by threatening to take their property and then doing so, as you saw in the Benchlands repeatedly, even though it doesn't give them adequate alternatives. And doing so without just violating straight state law. So I suppose, and it's been said by angry activists who are wondering why activists like myself and the Union of the Homeless People and, I don't know, Love Boat and Disability Rights Coalition, ACLU, Democratic Socialists of America aren't taking some action simply because there's certainly massive claims about and perhaps certainly some documentation of loss of property in these sweeps, which happened quite publicly and quite systematically by Larry Imwale and his boss, Matt Huffaker, the Santa Cruz city manager, in violation of state law that specifically says you got to hold property for a period of time. It's, what's it, 2 months or 3 months, and it's not being done. They're just dumpsterizing it. They're saying either you move everything immediately within a week, as they said this, eight different times to eight different groups of camps in parts of the Benchlands encampment, and then they destroyed all property that remained after the deadline, even though they forced people to leave the area and didn't allow them to come back and take their property, which is quite well documented, and you've heard about it on my show as well. Another plaintiff is Elitza Corley, 25 years old, a resident of Sevastopol. She grew up in the foster care system, according to the complaint, which exposed her to a great deal of instability, trauma, and violence. As a result of significant trauma, she has mental health disabilities in the form of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, depression, and anxiety, which makes it impossible for her to live in a congregate setting. She moved to Sevastopol in 2021 to take care of the son of a friend who later passed away. She has found a sense of community in Sevastopol and wishes to continue to live there, but cannot afford to rent on the income she earns from a series of part-time jobs. She previously lived in a vehicle on Morris Street and other locations in Sevastopol and is currently living at the village. Prior to moving into the village, her RV was ticketed and she was threatened with towing on multiple occasions. If the village closes, I assume that's an RV encampment perhaps, she will have no choice but to leave Sevastopol because she cannot live there in a vehicle under constant threat of being ticketed and having her vehicle and all her possessions taken from her. Ms. Corley has a disability-related need to live in his RV, I guess it means her RV if we're talking about a Ms., than on the streets of Sevastopol or in a congregate shelter. Her mental health disabilities make it impossible for her to live in a congregate setting around unfamiliar people. Having the private, safe space of her own that her RV provides allows her to manage her PTSD, anxiety, and depression, and protects her from the violence and harassment she would likely be exposed to as a young woman living in a congregate setting or alone on the street. Losing this shelter and safety would dramatically worsen Ms. Corley's mental health disabilities. And since attorneys, as I said, of these fancy organizations, ACLU and the Disability Rights Coalition and Legal Aid, are willing to, you know, invest and spend a lot of time and money on these kinds of cases, it shows that simply anxiety and PTSD and conditions of this kind, which numerous people have who are in the Benchlands, could, you know, could be used in a similar way there to you and in the future, where when police go after people in Santa Cruz, as they surely will, when complaints start coming in that the nervous Nelly Vanilla types want to have no homeless people in their neighborhood and don't want to be supporting what they call produces a magnet effect, to have other homeless people rushing in to serve, to experience some of the more wonderful harassment that folks are getting. If people think that living in the Benchlands was a wonderful experience, they really should talk to some of the people who lived there. And I say that not because I'm attacking the right of people in the Benchlands to maintain themselves there just until they found something better, but to indicate that some critics would tell you that, oh, we're just supporting all these lazy, layabout, junkie types, these alcoholics, these people who made bad life choices, and now we have to pay for them. And, of course, the irony is the payment that is being done is much more expensive by driving people out to different places. So anyway, this all came, I got this, sort of was directed to this case by a section in the Street Spirit newspaper, the current one that I encourage people to take a look at, titled Sevastopol CA City Bans RVs on City Streets for 15 Hours a Day, Now Advocates Are Suing. And I read you extensive stuff on that. And let's take another musical break.
Preach you a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean Adam in the Bible, Dadam. I don't mean Adam that Mother Eve mated. I mean that thing that science liberated. Einstein says he's scared. And if Einstein's scared, boy, I'm scared. Well, if you're scared of the A-bomb, here's what to do. You got to join with all the people in the world with you. Because if we don't get together and do it well, first thing you know, we'll blow this world up. Moral as plain as day. Old man Adam is here to stay. He's gonna stick around, it's plain to see. But ah, my dearly beloved, are we? We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men may be cremated equal. You know, life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was just a super toy. Folks got born, they'd work and marry, and Adam was a word in the dictionary. Then it happened. These science guys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime. Before you knew it, the job was done. They'd hitched up the power. The doggone sun put a harness on old Sol. Splitting atoms right and left, while the diplomats were splitting hairs. Of course, the cartel crowd up and put on a show. They're gonna turn back the clock on the UNO. Grab a corner on atoms and maybe extinguish every darn atom can't speak English. Down with foreign-born atoms. America for American atoms. Step right up, folks, and atomize world peace. But the atoms international, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah, also Siberia. Whether you're white, black, red, or brown, the question is this, when you boil it down, to be or not to be. That is the question. Atoms to atoms and a dust to dust. If you listen to the money bag, something's bound to bust. Yes, it's up to the people, cause the atom don't care. You can't fence him in, he's just like air. He don't give a darn about any politics or who got what into whichever fix. All he wants to do is sit around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. Now, the answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there fastest with the most is atoms, but the people of the world must decide their fate. We gotta stick together or disintegrate.
And that was Talking Atom by Pete Seeger from the album Power to the People Protest Songs from probably the 50s or the 60s, maybe even the 40s. So this next interview is with Michael Oren, who is known perhaps, Michael Orr, sorry, not Oren, He's known more familiarly as, or you might know him, as Dreamcatcher. And he's a someone I regularly get interviews with, and I kind of want to, kind of been following him over the years, so to speak, or at least occasionally running into him. And I ran into him today at the town clock, where he's the son of a community that gathers during the Food Not Bombs meal. And kind of clustering on the outskirts are also some, I wouldn't call them shelters or tents. They don't like to be called that, partially because it's an invitation to a police sweep, perhaps. But in any case, he talks about the aftermath of the Benchlands demolition Tuesday before last, which would have been on Tuesday, the 1st of November. So here he is.
Let's hear about it. We're here at the Food Not Bombs meal. It's 10 to 2. I suppose I should. Do I have a chair? I don't see no... Well, hang on a second here, folks. So I'm sitting in a chair on the sidewalk across from Food Not Bombs. And the... Yes, sir, I won't. Thank you for letting me use the chair, man. I appreciate it.
I gave him permission. Thank you, Jedi.
It's his fault.
Yes, it is. I'm claiming.
So, Dreamcatcher, you're here on the, I guess you might call it the Coast Commercial Bank sidewalk, or is this whatever bank this is?
Donnie, what's up, Donnie?
Santa Cruz County Bank.
They just closed. They just had a moving van move everything out yesterday.
Including the money?
I don't think it was a money bank.
Oh, really? What is a bank but a money bank? I don't know nothing about that.
Well, it could be banking on issues or banking on certificates.
Banking on the ignorance of the majority?
Banking on the transference of what is to what is movable and then back to what is.
But the first thing you told me when I came up here is that this... The few items you have here on the sidewalk, although it doesn't look like an entirely few, if all this is yours, this indicates the residue of what remains from what was lost.
Yes, which was probably a portable studio I had in my tent for my artwork and my music, I guess, you know, and my living.
And I visited you in that area, which was phase 8 of the... Well, phase 8 of the demolition of the Benchlands moved that area, well, dumped that area, and except what people could scurry away with.
Yes, it turns out that way. I've been through many of these. It gets pretty ruthless down at the end because of the compaction of everybody. Nobody being able to keep an eye on everything. It's very difficult, even if you're sitting in your own frickin' front yard. My guitar walks off, but I got it back, thankfully. And when we were all spread out, the corporations of corruption or crime, or I call it crap, you know, this fiduous stuff, and what it makes people do, is kind of scary. I've had 5 friends in 3 days die from overdoses of fentanyl.
Want to name some of them?
Savage. Let's see. Who's the other? Just take my name. You know, Mark. He was my neighbor. He was my next door neighbor. Mark the Carver that had the big dog named George. He's gone. They said he had a heart attack in jail. I go, really? Number one, I guess it's the number one way you die in a system, I guess. I don't know. But it surprised me. Mark was younger than me. He worked awful hard, though, you know. And I'm not sure, you know, what the causes of that. Maybe he, you know, he was a fighter. He's a feisty guy. And then there was a girlfriend's friend of mine that mistakenly taken some white powder for some coke. I heard the rumor, and it was the other thing. And she, you know, nobody had any Narcan, They weren't expecting it. It was truly, you know, an accident or something, which is a bummer. It was a girlfriend's friend of mine. I don't partake myself. I never have. I've seen too much damage, you know, from one hit, you know, when somebody's not informed about the pipe, that there's fetia in it. They find out after they're exhaling and falling down on the floor in front of me. I warned them. I'm going to just keep on drawing. I'm serious. I don't know what to do. I'm not strong enough. My back is killing me. So anyway, kind of humorous, but it's happened. Luckily, there are some other people there. The move that we had, I guess it was a rumor when they were going to have some containers for us to move our stuff into, but that would have been ridiculous, actually.
Sorry if I held you up.
That would have been ridiculous to have all that trash and stuff that had to have been separated, you know, from food and clothing and stuff that I'm old to just, I guess, storable.
You lost your stuff on the, what it would be, Tuesday before last?
Right. When we had to, we had to move out of the benchland, okay? I made a good movie there. And then we slept there, right there on the bicycle trail up there by the playground.
For how long?
Till the next morning, and then that's when I was informed that the dump trucks are coming, you know, and I'm going, whoa.
Were you able to move your stuff up to the trail on Tuesday, and then they told you had to move from the trail, but were you able to get most of your stuff that you wanted up to the trail initially?
Yes.
And what you said then was when you began to lose your stuff more seriously?
Well, I had this little trailer and this bike, and it started raining, and the main trail was blocked by everybody else trying to get out and get up and get this trash out that they're not going to be able to take any further than what they can carry. And it's the truth. I've been trying to tell them. And,
this was on Wednesday?
Yes. Yeah, when the dump trucks came, I guess. I wasn't there. I was so upset about leaving my whole portfolio there, all my tools. I mean, like, whoa, it hurts. It's been the most abrupt purge. You know, this is like the fifth time that this is...
Lost all your artwork or some of it?
Everything. I managed to salvage my guitar, my amp, and my stove, and a jacket, and a sleeping pad, and a good sleeping bag. I did get a nice tent from Food Not Bombs. I'm okay there. But when I get a migraine, I can't even set up my tent. And I got wet the other night, the wettest I've ever gotten, in front of the Women's Center behind the library, because the guy there that was the alarm guy kept pushing the alarm button to get me off the porch. And I had such a headache, I wasn't going to care. I was setting up shop anyway. And then the cops came.
There you go. Hey, my friend.
When are you going to start that meal again?
Well, that's a good question. But I do have something if you're interested in coming.
What would that be?
It would be at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Well, this is going out at 6 o'clock tonight, so maybe next week people can know about it. Tell me a little bit more.
It's going to be a baptism in the San Lorenzo River.
Oh, well, that can't happen every week, I don't think.
No. So it's a special thing, 4 o'clock today. We're going to meet at the footbridge, Dreamcatcher. Right by Trader Joe's.
I know you're talking about.
Yeah.
Who's being baptized?
Her name is X-Ann.
She's X-Ann, yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you do to persuade her to pick up your religious beliefs, sir?
She just came up to me and said, I want to be baptized.
And you consented to this obscene behavior?
Well, what we do is, as a priest, anybody who desires to be baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we say...
Baptize them, but don't feed them, that sort of thing.
No, don't drown them.
Don't drown them as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was curious because I think that, I mean, I much appreciated the opportunity to meet people on Monday, though now, of course, there's a daily meal here. Is there some reason that the meals have not, and the activities that happen on the Monday cafe has not resumed?
Well, that's a decision by the church, and I'm no longer the rector there.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
I would love it to happen. But it's a community that has to decide that they're going to do
Perhaps
that.
We can do it in honor of Cynthia Matthews.
Well, why in honor of her?
Heck, she has.
I don't think she's dead.
Well, only in some certain spiritual respects, perhaps. Although none of us is truly spiritually dead.
Agreed.
Thank you for saying that.
Anyway. We need witnesses.
Okay, yeah.
And we do provide food. I distribute bagels and socks every Friday.
And where do people pick these up?
Well, we've been doing it at the San Lorenzo River, but we have to find a new location.
And you don't quite know where that's going to be.
We're going to do it tomorrow up and down the San Lorenzo River. There's still people there.
And they're in the parking garages.
Okay.
I slept there last night, and there's about 10 of us.
Oh, okay.
And what time does this happen Friday?
Usually at 10 o'clock.
And up and down the river, but you've got to kind of look for the roaming team? Or
we're the roaming team. They're pretty much fixed in place.
So I see. So if you hang out on the river, you might end up getting some socks.
So we go up and down the river with our cart, and we have socks and bagels.
Sounds like you're picking up where the rabbi left off.
I did that before as well. So, anyway, Robert, Green Pastor, I got to go.
Been talking with
Joel.
That's Joel Miller.
Yeah, okay.
Get my name in the paper.
Before you baptize anybody in that river, I mean, that's great. You're going to do that?
Yeah.
But before you baptize anybody, it's so filthy, you're going to have to baptize the river first.
Nice looking. This is your latest work here?
Yes, this is the beginning of my new portfolio. It starts with mushrooms and a mushroom riding a wave and a flaming rainbow feather and some Rorschachs and a kundalini thing. And see, I got a packet of 8 pieces of paper. And, it's just that I didn't have the capability of saving it because I had no place to take it.
Is this available for seizure by a commercial entity like myself?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And what is the, shall we say, donation expectation of this particular item?
From you, a half a cigarette.
I'm not a smoker, son. Talk nasty.
No. My price list is kind of funny. It's like 20 is cool, 10 enough, 5 just enough, and 2 sacrifice.
And 1 too little.
And yeah, there's nothing you can't do. There's no such thing as a dollar store. It's a $2 store in New Zealand.
Yeah, or it's actually a $1.25 store up where I live.
Right, and we're paying what for containers today or cups today or something? Plastic bags.
That's right. They are charging for that now.
That's right.
In the Scotts Valley.
I don't have any clear coat. That would go to some spray lacquer, because then these things that I am working on.
Let me see if I can find some resources. Shown your work, a Dreamcatcher, but of course you can't really see it as a netcast does not do essentially justice to it. So let me ask you a couple other items. You say last night you were in the parking garage. How have the police been treating people outside in the last week?
You know what? They've been very, very polite and cordial and patient, because people just on the sidelines start saying stupid things to them. I look at them, I'm going, what the heck are you doing, man? Trying to pick a fight with a cop? You're an idiot. I don't say it out loud, but that's what I'm thinking, because I've seen it a few times.
This is when they see police accosting people who are sleeping?
No, just walking by.
Not happy with Lieutenant Jones and his removal behaviors?
Wasn't it Smith? Oh, Sergeant Smith.
No, it was Lieutenant...
Lieutenant Jones and Sergeant Smith,
did I miss
I think. And I'll get to signing in just a second. Yes, and they're very, you know, I can't believe I almost want to go over there and reprimand the person for, like, what are you talking to that cop for? Did he hurt you or something? Well, I don't do that. I just mind my own business. But that's how I feel and think. Because these officers here, the new officer that wakes you up in the morning, the young man, I call him the officer crash dummy.
True.
Officer crash dummy. Because the officer that accompanies the community service agent that comes and wakes us up nice and with a smile and with some dopey glasses on and a wave in his hair, and he's a youngster.
He doesn't bring coffee, though, does he?
I was making my own.
But did he wake you up, or did he wake you up and tell you to leave?
Well, it's time to go. We should be out of here, you know.
Because that spot is so necessary for someone else?
It just keeps people from getting the idea that just because they sleep there, they can move in and own the place.
The idea that they somehow have a right to set up a tent somewhere and leave their stuff with somebody else and not have to carry it around with them all day, that crazy idea?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I gave a guy a legit blanket of mine just because I caught him stealing somebody else's, and I'm going, here, you know, this one's legit, you might sleep better tonight. He came back and he said, do you want your blanket back? I go, no, dude.
Yeah, did you take your blanket back?
No, I gave it to him because something happens, you know.
Well, the point, though, is that obviously you can't carry all this stuff around with you every day. Well, you have a cart, so you have more. But, I mean, it's a burden for you to pack this shit up every day.
Yes, it is. I try not to set up a tent. It's nice when I don't have to because I pull a tarp over everything anyway, just to keep people from, you know, plucking things, because there's a notorious...
Has that been successful the last week and a half after all your stuff was taken, or much of it?
It wasn't taken. I just had to leave it behind, and it got plucked. I mean, right there on the levee, right in the middle of Fedia Alley.
So it was destroyed, you think, or...
I see my stuff everywhere.
So it was taken for commercial use?
It was taken by advantage because it was abandoned, and I had nice stuff. I mean, I've been working on my gathering for...
But not truly abandoned. You left it where it was in the hopes of coming back to get it?
No, because I had no place to take it. I had no way of transporting it except for one piece at a time. My tool bag would have been very burdensome, but, you know...
Were there any members of the community helping you on this Wednesday or helping others move their stuff?
You know, I want to thank this one lady that I always... cross the bridge against, and she always says, you know, walk your bike to me, and she's kind of a take back Santa Cruz guardian. But she was there, and she was, you know, giving out soup. It's a very familiar older lady. I mean, when I say older, I say my age now.
Very short lady or not?
Short. That's Jean. I know her very well. Right. Okay, she works at the check cashing place.
And the UN Association.
Right. And a lot of people are buying my paintings because I donate my paintings. She really likes my mushroom paintings, like, go all the time in there.
Oh, they're a favorite up in Felton, I can tell you that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Me, anyway.
Well, thank you. That makes me feel good also. Because I'm going to get it back in gear. I'm lucky I just saved one box of really good pens and Felton markers. But all those supplies that I had to leave behind, my back is killing me. But anyway, I made a good movie because I signed a release. Remember the movie we made, Robert?
I do not.
Just look at the tree. Remember that shot at the end of our interview? Because they filmed our interview. When you walked up, I was giving an interview already to some college students that were making...
Oh, right on the bridge, you mean.
Right. I was giving it.
That was about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Right, when the squeezing was being done, when it was squeezed down to two, we were there. Because one of the lines...
Two phases that were left of the Benchlands campground.
One of the... borders was right under the bridge where we were standing. So it was interesting. We did good. I signed a release, so they're going to use most of it.
And the main videographer was actually at the Huff meeting today. You should, if you can make it to a Huff meeting, come and check it out. Okay. She shows up regularly. Rita, her name is.
Right. Okay, I will. When's the next one?
Thursday at 10:45.
Next Thursday. Am I late?
Next Thursday.
Yeah, I'm not.
Unfortunately, yes, you are late. My apologies.
Hey, Dan.
What's up? How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing a professional interview, so don't.
Amateur.
Dan is a new guy. He was the coffee guy down at Lot 27 when we were there, and has turned out to be consistently kooky, and so he fits right in.
Consistently kooky. I like it.
Plus, I show up.
We call him Hammock Hank.
I was hanging in my hammock today.
Yeah. See what I mean?
How have the police been treating you, Hammock Hank?
How the police?
Good. I've been hiding. They don't
seek you out.
Right. Homeless Persons Health Project found me a place.
Very good. How long did it take for them to do that?
In my mind, it took years because I was still being diagnosed and beginning the process of getting on Social Security.
Did you require a diagnosis in order to get any kind of income?
Yes, I did.
Right.
Yes, I did.
So it is.
It's wonderful to have an advocate when you go into the Social Security
Administration.
Yeah, because it's designed for people to give up and fail.
That's the way of saving money. It's prudent, very prudent.
You see,
we don't want to, deprive the middle class of what little it still has. And what about those upper class people who need more to invest?
They need their PPP laws.
I PP on those laws myself, yes. Any experience in the last... Were you in the benchlands at any time or not?
He was helping. A lot, but not living there.
Not a resident. Right. Were you around on Wednesday after the benchlands final clearing or not? That's when Dreamcatcher was moving his...
You were there during the final clearing,
but after the final clearing, the day later, when people were on the path with their stuff.
I looked over and saw it, but I didn't go over there.
Sounds like me, actually.
So
you left poor Dreamcatcher in the lurch. Had you been there...
Almost.
Yeah,
he did help me push my trailer up.
Had I been there, had either of us been there.
He did help me push my trailer up the hill a couple of times. Yes, he did.
We will remember that in Hades when you and I both agree.
He was split between two lovers, Ernie and I. So
Dan, between two lovers.
Yeah, Dan did his best to help. He did.
I should have probably stolen that bike and trailer.
You could have been a contender, son.
Yes.
You're too damn honest. That's one of the problems.
Yeah, too damn honest. There we go.
Tredi, any comments while you walk by?
No, I've got my license back, so things are looking okay for me. I've still got to go to court, but that looks like it's going to work out in my best interest.
Good, and of course, millions of dollars will be coming in lawsuits at some point.
At some point, yeah,
yeah.
Right. All right.
Thank you, Jenna.
No worries.
All right. Well, Dreamcatcher, I have a... she looks like she's all right, waiting in the car. Anything that you want to say on behalf of these people who have died that you remember about them that, I don't know, might be worth hearing for people who either knew them and those who didn't?
Yes, they were considered probably some part of the family, okay? There's some that are drinkers, there's some that are smokers, and there's some that are...
Fentanyl smokers. Fentanyl.
Yeah, I'm trying to just generalize that there's different camps.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but we all try to get along. There's a code there, you know, don't steal, you know, don't rip people off. You know, it's not always, you have a lot of abuse and addictions, so that happens all the time. I saw a lot of weird stuff, you know. I saw the guy burn up in the tent. We didn't know there was a guy in there, though. We saw somebody escape. We thought, you know, everything's cool, but then when the fire was over, there was bones in there. That happened about 50 feet away from me and my friend. We didn't know what to do, you know. Then